At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's one thing to evacuate if you're healthy and strong. Today, how to get the sick to safety. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood in the chair for Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 6th of October. Glad to be with you. The death toll from Hurricane Matthew continues to rise. In Georgia, a mandatory evacuation order has been issued for more than 500,000 people. And the governor of Florida has asked 2 million people there to evacuate their homes as the storm approaches. Gigi Brown is hunkered down in a family shelter in Palm Beach County.
I'm with family and friends and dogs and cats. And I'm one of these people that doesn't have homeowners insurance. I don't. It's about 20% of my income to afford homeowners insurance. We'll just ride this out for tonight and go back and check on the damage tomorrow.
Now, of course, as we talked about yesterday, evacuating your home or business can be expensive and difficult for anyone. But it can be much harder for people who have chronic illnesses, people who may need dialysis machines, constant power, or critical medications. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein looks at efforts that are happening to care for some of Florida's sickest residents.
For the past several days, Dr. Mina Cotonier and his staff have been working the phones, calling their patients with diabetes and kidney failure.
And made sure that they had their medications. Do they have any needs? Are they having any shortness of breath right now?
Cotonier works for the physician practice Chen Med, headquartered in South Florida. In the run-up to the storm, staff identified the most vulnerable 400 to 600 patients. And now, Cotonier says, they're getting these folks whatever they need.
A patient was running out of the oxygen yesterday. That oxygen was made available to them at no cost because it's an emergency situation.
Not every sick patient is so lucky. Federal statistics show more than 50,000 Americans on Medicare need dialysis in the states most likely to get hit by Matthew. The Department of Health and Human Services, Dr. Nicole Lurie, says in the past, chronically ill patients have struggled during natural disasters.
When you evacuate, it's a very stressful situation. You're away from your support system. And we know that stress exacerbates disease, makes it worse. And we know that when your disease gets worse, you have a higher chance of dying from it.
Studies show in the wake of these terrible floods and hurricanes, visits to emergency rooms and hospitals spike by as much as 25%. Dr. Rick DeShazo at University of Mississippi Medical Center says they saw that firsthand after Katrina.
So it's a matter of leadership. Medical centers, private hospital systems are in a position to provide great amount of care to these folks.
DeShazo says the medical communities that receive people fleeing from the storm need to step up and do what's necessary or run the risk of very sick people getting worse. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
If you visited a McDonald's today, you may have encountered more than just the typical lunchtime lines, like, say, a protest out front. The fast food giant is the subject of 15 federal complaints about rampant sexual harassment, and workers staged protests in 36 cities around the country. But here's the thing about McDonald's. It's a franchise. So lots of the restaurants where problems allegedly happened are owned by individuals and not the corporation. So who's liable? Sally Herships checks it out.
At a McDonald's in Midtown Manhattan, protesters are angry. About 40 of them have gathered. They're holding signs like, "We're workers," but not that kind of worker.
Everywhere we go!
It's not just a McDonald's issue. A new survey from a group of women's advocacy organizations says 40% of female employees at all fast food restaurants have been sexually harassed. But most fast food restaurants are franchises. So can the parent corporation like McDonald's be held responsible?
There's a trend towards trying to hold corporate franchisors liable for the activity of their franchisees.
Melissa Chan is a lawyer with Carrie Kane. The firm specializes in employment law. She says it used to be hard to pin problems on corporate entities, but in 2014, that changed. That's when the National Labor Relations Board pushed to expand what's called joint employment. That means the franchise owner and the parent company can be on the hook when problems come up.
Now it looks like they're going to be held responsible more often because under the new standard, a franchisor is a joint employer if it directly controls the employee's activities.
Which some legal experts say McDonald's does. Angela Cornell teaches law at Cornell.
So the McDonald's franchise agreement covers employee training, many aspects of operations. It requires franchisees to comply with many policies, corporate policies.
Cornell says it's not just the National Labor Relations Board. The Department of Labor is also pushing for changes to ensure employers are accountable to their employees. McDonald's says it has a zero-tolerance policy against sexual harassment, and workers are demanding the company enforce it. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, Twitter shares collapsed overnight as rumored bidders like Google, Apple, and Disney reportedly bowed out. And Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff, well, he waffled. We'll have the rest of the market news when we do the numbers. We are just barely over a month away from Election Day, and the voter registration push is ramping up. About 1 in 4 Americans is not registered to vote, and it can be expensive to find and sign up those people. Some states make it easier than others. Oregon voters can go to the DMV. Minnesota allows voters to register as late as Election Day. But in other places, civic groups do much of the legwork to track down potential voters. That's the case in Georgia, as Johnny Kaufman of WABE reports.
It's Saturday at a Walmart outside Atlanta. Wayne Brumfeld is headed inside to shop for his mom. He just moved here from Louisiana.
She's getting a little older and my brothers are in the service. So I was like the only one left.
Before Brumfeld enters the store, he's stopped by some people with clipboards.
You're welcome. Anybody need to get registered today?
Staff and volunteers are here with the New Georgia Project, a nonprofit. They're focused on registering minority voters, but they don't turn anybody away. This neighborhood is about 75% African American. Rumfeld just signed up. He says he's voting for the good of his 3 boys.
I had it hard coming up. So I know what it's like. I'd rather them have a better chance than what I did.
Between work and family, Rumfeld doesn't have a lot of time and says he might not have registered if it weren't for what he calls the curbside service at the Walmart. If this is a drive-through for voter registration, the New Georgia Project is best known for its delivery service. Half of its registration work is door-to-door canvassing.
That's expensive work, and for a lot of the states where this work could be done, they simply don't have the resources.
Stacey Abrams is Georgia's Democratic House Minority Leader and founder of the nonpartisan New Georgia Project. She says the group is unique because it does the labor-intensive work of finding voters at their homes.
These are folks no one talks to, so you've got to pay literally hundreds of people to go and knock on doors and stand in the hot sun in July in Georgia and get people to engage.
The group's registration effort has attracted harsh scrutiny from both Democrats and Republicans. In 2014, Georgia's Republican Secretary of State opened an ongoing investigation into the New Georgia Project over allegations it submitted fraudulent voter applications. A countersuit by the group alleging voter suppression was thrown out. And some Democrats say the New Georgia Project should be signing up more people, given the amount of money it has raised from private donors. Brennan Mansell says registration is a focus for Republicans, too.
You have to involve people who are going to be the voting base of the future.
Mansell is chairman of the Georgia Association of College Republicans.
And by and large, it's going to be Hispanics, blacks, and to a lesser degree than now, whites.
Mansell says his group registers voters in student centers and at debate watch parties. These kinds of high traffic areas are the most common and most efficient way to sign people up. But Bradley Spahn, a Stanford graduate student who studies unregistered voters, says it can be expensive to try and find people who don't have stable housing, a listed address, or a phone.
Even if we wanted to register them, we wouldn't be able to find contact information for them. We wouldn't know how to register them because we would never know they existed.
Spahn says Democrats probably have the most to gain from registering those hard-to-find voters, who tend to be more liberal. But in addition to being costly, it takes time.
Party politics is run by short-term considerations. Campaigns disappear in the middle of November.
Back at the Walmart, the New Georgia Project's long-term plan is paying off, at least with Wayne Brumfeld. He'll be casting a vote for himself, but with his young sons in mind.
I have 11, 8, and a 6-year-old, so it'll be a while before they get a chance to do that.
Many voter registration deadlines are this month, though they vary from state to state. In Atlanta, I'm Johnny Kaufman for Marketplace.
A very, very, very bad string of events for Samsung is not over yet. A Southwest flight had to be evacuated Tuesday after a Samsung Galaxy Note 7 started smoking and popping as the flight was boarding in Louisville, Kentucky. Now, I know you heard stories about Galaxy Note 7 phones exploding, but the passenger says this was his replacement Galaxy Note 7 that he got from the company after its global smartphone recall. Samsung told us it cannot confirm that until it retrieves the device, but the company has a lot more on its plate right now than just identifying this one melted down smartphone. From our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman reports.
Samsung has already been reeling from the massive recall last month of its newest high-end smartphone, the one that was supposed to take on Apple's new iPhone and wow tech bloggers and consumers. Instead, what the South Korea-based company's got is a possibly botched recall, says business professor David Ross at the University of Florida.
They create a general sense in the public that, oh my God, this is the most dangerous phone ever. That's why it's so important for them to try to deal with this. You know, we made a mistake, never going to happen again kind of a thing. And hopefully you folks in the media will move on to the next thing.
Until now, moving on is just what Samsung's been trying to do, says Troy Stangerone at the Korea Economic Institute. He says the company jumped on the recall, got software patches and replacement phones out quickly.
So I think they've tried to be as customer friendly and as efficient as you possibly can. But the longer the story goes on, I think the more questions people will have about Samsung's phone and whether they should consider it or consider an alternative.
Usha Haley teaches management at West Virginia University and has authored numerous books on Asian business. She thinks Samsung's already lost the current battle with Apple, iPhone 7 versus Galaxy Note 7.
When government agencies in the United States flag it as a danger, that's a huge hit to the brand name. It just should get to the next generation, the next item, the next model, maybe number 8.
She says that's so the company can move on to its next major challenge, competing for new customers in the world's biggest smartphone market, China. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I have not seen one land contract in the city of Detroit that was good.
Predatory loans and why they're the only option for some people in Detroit. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 12 points, less than 0.1%, to close at 18,268. The NASDAQ lost 9 points, 0.1%, to finish at 5306. And the S&P 500 gained a point, remaining pretty much unchanged to end at 2160. We mentioned Samsung's recent troubles after news a plane had to be evacuated because of a smoking phone. Samsung Electronics still dialed up 4.4%. Apple boosted 0.6%. Lenovo Group powered up 1.5%. News about a potential Twitter sale seems to be moving about as fast as it takes to retweet it, but Twitter trolled down more than 20%. Bonds fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.73%, and you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. All right, I'm going to set up this next segment by playing you a little of this.
She blinded me with science. She blinded me with science.
That, of course, is the 1982 hit, She Blinded Me with Science. I'm sorry for the earworm, because trust me, it's going to last for days. That song is the first hit by a guy named Thomas Dolby. He would go on to have a long career in music before bringing that music into the tech world. What set him apart was his ability to combine his music talents with, as he says, his talents as a tinkerer. Thomas Dolby's new memoir is called The Speed of Sound, Breaking the Barriers Between Music and Technology, and he joins me now. Hi, Thomas.
Hello there.
So you write in this book that in some ways your life completely changed because of something you found in the garbage. Can you tell me that story?
Yes. It was the winter of discontent in London, England, a very cold winter, and there were garbage strikes. And in a dumpster at the end of my road, I found the innards of a kit-built synthesizer. And I took it home and got out my soldering iron and managed to get it working. And that was the start of my career in electronic music.
Hey, what a moment. So then let's fast forward to the music career. You had a huge hit with a song called She Blinded Me with Science. It was all over MTV at the time, right? How did your life change then?
You know, I never really set out to be a pop star. My father and his father and his father before him were all Cambridge professors. My mother taught algebra. And I'd always been a fan of silent movies, and I really saw a music video as an opportunity to sort of make a silent movie with a soundtrack. So, mm-hmm. In fact, I made the video for She Blinded Me with Science without really having a song. And my record company said, looked at the storyboard, said, this is great, but, you know, where's the music to go with it? And I said, oh, I'll bring that in on Monday morning.
And you did? You just wrote it in a weekend?
I wrote it over a weekend and brought it in on Monday, and they let me shoot the video, and it went straight to the top of the chart.
And then what happened after that? Pop star success did not come quite so easily anymore?
I didn't really enjoy being in the limelight. Mm. I started to sort of take more of a back seat and play more as a producer, as a songwriter, as a keyboard player, and then started doing music for films and eventually games and virtual reality.
Yeah, you're really credited with being basically a big force behind bringing music and sound to the internet. Talk to me about forming Headspace and how that evolves into Beatnik.
So I had a group of very brilliant, very musical programmers and engineers in a small startup company in San Mateo. And we would have gone up in smoke the way of so many other dot-com companies were it not for the fact that we had one deal with some teeth. When Nokia needed a synthesizer to make ringtones in their handset. So they licensed our Beatnik audio engine technology and embedded it in their phones in 1999. And since then, every Nokia phone that has shipped has had our little synthesizer in it. And that's what you're hearing when you hear those annoying ringtones.
Yeah, in fact, we have that tape.
Can I tell you how that came about?
Please.
An engineer was tuning the ringer on a Nokia phone to find the most annoying frequency for the ring. And a marketing guy stuck his head around the door and said, oh, you've got them playing music now. And a lawyer said, no, you can't just ship pop songs on a mobile phone. You've got music publishers, you've got songwriters. And somebody said, well, what if it's by a dead guy? Are any of these by dead guys? And the engineer goes, yeah, this one. Diddly-dee-diddly-dee-diddly-dee-dee. That guy's been dead for 150 years. And they said, okay, let's ship it.
And thus the Nokia Waltz was born. I love that. Tell me about sort of bridging these two cultures. On the one hand, you know, the book starts with amphetamines, cocaine, chain-smoking, the pop star lifestyle. We encounter Michael Jackson, David Bowie, George Clinton, Parliament, Funkadelic. And then you go to the Valley and you're in this completely other, I would imagine, cultural scene, the dot-com boom, its eventual bust. Can you contrast that for me? What is that like?
It was a very different scene. There was a period in the middle of the 90s where any idiot with half an idea jotted on the back of an envelope could get a venture capitalist to write him a check. And it was pointed out to me that in Detroit in the 1920s, there were something like 1,500 automobile companies. Some of them were making cars with tillers. And and the same, in the same way, there was this sort of obstacle course, this survival mechanism that kicked in. And so although it was, as you say, not as glamorous, not as fast-paced as the rock and roll world, it had the potential from the start to make a huge difference in the lives of people on the planet. And that was what thrilled me about it.
And now you're teaching at Johns Hopkins. Why make that shift now?
I realized when I got to a certain point in my life that all through my career, I'd had nobody really to show me the ropes. And I thought, okay, in today's scene is very different. And for kids coming through school and through college now, maybe I could pass on some of that wisdom and experience to them. And my ancestors, were they still around, would be tickled pink to see that after all these years, young Thomas finally joined the family firm.
Thomas Dolby is the author of The Speed of Sound, Breaking the Barriers Between Music and Technology, on bookshelves this month. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Yesterday on the program, we played you a piece about Detroit's housing market, where prices are really low, but there is little to no mortgage lending going on. That leaves only a few options for that housing stock. One, the homes sit empty. Two, they get bought by someone who can pay cash. Or three, they are financed through much more controversial means, something called a land contract, which some say is just a predatory loan by another name. Lewis Wallace has that story.
Eddie Cave spends a lot of time in front of his house in his electric wheelchair, which is connected up to a generator in the back. He's had a couple surgeries on his knees recently and uses an oxygen tank for a respiratory condition. He props his leg up as he sits and watches his quiet street.
Everyone in this block gets along. We try to keep it as clean as we can, you know.
Eddie's 57 and lives off disability. He bought this house a couple years ago, and it was just $2,500. Payable on what's called a land contract. It's basically a loan, but a loan from the seller. So it works a lot like rent to own. The person or company selling the house will draw up a contract. The buyer makes a down payment, moves in, and makes remaining payments directly to the seller. But it usually has much, much higher interest than a normal mortgage.
I've been trying to fix it up, you know.
It's a beautiful old house.
Yeah, it's not a bad house.
Before he moved in, scrappers had stripped the furnace, the electric wiring, the bathroom sink. He started replacing the windows and patching the leaks, but in the middle of that process, he started having to use the wheelchair more regularly and had to stop.
Have you lived in this house over winter?
Yes.
With
yes.
No furnace?
Yes. Oh my God. Actually, I heated it up with kerosene heaters.
In the kitchen, he has a camp stove for cooking. There are gallon bottles of water lined up on the dining room table. Eddie Cave still doesn't actually own this house. There was some fine print in the contract he signed with the sellers, and they expected him to pay all their unpaid taxes on the house. They said it would be $1,400. It turned out to be even more.
I let them know that I couldn't do it, but they wanted it anyway.
I have not seen one land contract in the city of Detroit that was good.
This is Charlene Snow, a lawyer in Detroit's bustling landlord-tenant court. She says she's been seeing more and more cases like Eddie's, where sellers try to evict would-be buyers over back taxes or one missed payment. So in effect, the people trying to buy the house have the responsibilities of an owner, with less protection even than a renter, paying high rent.
I rent on a home that's a piece of crap and uninhabitable until they make all the repairs.
And land contracts are being used this way all over the country, especially in places hard hit by the housing crisis. Most land contracts also aren't reported to the county or federal regulators. In Detroit, the housing market finally bottomed out a few years ago, but there are still lots of foreclosures. And credit is tight. A lot of people have bad credit, or the houses are so messed up traditional lenders won't accept them as collateral. So investors who have cash can buy low and jack up the prices. But that's usually still a good deal for the buyer. That's what Sonny Mandu argues. He's a real estate broker here.
Come to the table with $3,000 and you can walk away with a deed to a house. You know, there's nowhere else in the world you can do that.
He He says people selling houses don't really have a choice but to offer land contracts in markets like this with so little lending going on. But he also admits it can be a way for investors to just dump a bad investment, back taxes and all, like this local outfit tried to do to Eddie Cave. I repeatedly tried to contact the sellers of Eddie's house. Two numbers were disconnected. A third just goes to voicemail, and they haven't called back. Eddie says he's focused on what's next.
It's my home right now, so when I get up on my feet, hopefully I can help make a change. You know what I mean? Excuse me.
Once he has this paid off and figures out how to get a new furnace, he wants to use his energy helping other people avoid getting taken advantage of. I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
This final note before we go about a hot tech IPO on the horizon. The Wall Street Journal reporting that Snapchat, now officially known as Snap, may be preparing an initial public offering that would value the company at about $25 billion, and that it could happen as soon as March. The journal notes that it would be the biggest IPO in the United States since 2014. Snap has had success selling ads on its disappearing message platform. It forecast up to $350 million in revenue this year, up to $1 billion in 2017. I imagine, however, that the company will list one significant business concern in its S-1 filing. Biggest challenge to growth? Grown-ups can't figure out how to use it. All right, we got to go. Today, the Dow fell 12 points, less than 0.1%. The NASDAQ lost 9 points, 0.1%. And the S&P 500 gained a point, basically unchanged. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Abe Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon. I am Molly Wood, and we will see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.